So we're looking at Matthew chapter 9, verse 35, through to chapter 10, verse 15. And this passage then, it's easy to understand. It's not like one of the visions in the book of Daniel that we've been looking at fairly recently. You don't read this passage this morning and kind of think to yourself, what on earth is this about? There's a sheep simile there, there's a harvest metaphor, there's a funny title, Simon the Cananean, there's a culturally specific practice mentioned, shaking the dust off one's feet, but that's about as tricky as the passage gets. As I say, it's easy to understand. However, that doesn't mean that my sermon preparation this past week was a doddle that took no time at all. This passage has its difficulties. It's just that they're not at the level of meaning. The meaning is straightforward. Rather, they're at the level of relevance and application. That's where this passage poses problems. Its theme, of course, is the sending out by Jesus of his 12 apostles, these men whose names are listed for us in chapter 10, verses 2 to 4. And already then, that kind of distances the passage from our situation this morning, doesn't it? Because we are not apostles. Apostles, we know from Ephesians 2:20, had a foundational role in God's new covenant people. That's the language that Paul uses. And the foundation, you all know, is laid just once at the start of a building project. It's put in place, and then that's it. The builders move on to the next phase of the structure. And similarly, the 12 apostles, they only existed once. They were there for a period, but God's church building project has now moved on to a different phase. And so, as I say, we are not apostles. And so that's an issue that we face when we come to this passage that's all about the apostles being sent out. But actually, that's not the main problem. If you glance down the page a little, you'll notice that Jesus' instructions in chapter 10 to the 12 apostles, they begin in verse 5, but they actually continue right up until the end of the chapter. The first verse of chapter 11 makes that clear, when Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples. So we're dealing here with a lengthy section of instruction, and it's a bit like another lengthy section of teaching that we have in this gospel, the one we have in chapter 24. And you know how in that chapter Jesus begins by talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple that was going to occur a few decades later in AD 70. But then at some point, and without any warning, the horizon changes in that chapter, and he's talking about the very end of the age. And it's a bit similar here. We have here too in chapter 10 a kind of unannounced change of horizon. It occurs just after the point where we're stopping this morning, just after verse 15. And it's obvious even then from just a casual glance at verse 16 onwards that Jesus is no longer talking there about this immediate mission that the 12 apostles are being sent out on. For one thing, the Gentiles come into the equation. They're mentioned in verse 18. And for another thing, the main theme of that whole section from 16 onwards is persecution. And persecution on a scale that the apostles simply will not face during the period that Jesus is still living on earth. In other words, verses 16 to 42 refer to the apostles' ministry in the future, beyond Jesus' return to heaven, beyond the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. What we're looking at this morning, on the other hand, that refers to the apostles' ministry during the time Jesus is still living on earth. And so you can see then how that distances the passage even further from our situation this morning. I'm saying the apostles' ministry as a whole was an unrepeatable phase that would end a few decades later. And what we're dealing with here in our passage this morning is an unrepeatable phase within that unrepeatable phase that would end just 3 years later. And so with this kind of double barrier separating our passage from where we are at in 2019 this morning, what are we to do with it? Well, an obvious approach is to apply the text by way of a series of contrasts. So our situation, living as we do at this much later stage in God's program of redemption, it's different from that of the apostles when Jesus was still on earth, and it's different in this particular way, and it's different in that way, and it's different in that way. And that basically is the approach that we're going to follow this morning, but with a nuance. We are going to consider a series of contrasts, but bound up with each contrast between our situation and the apostles' situation back in this passage, bound up with each contrast, there's also something that stays the same. Something that we still have in common with the apostles here in the passage. And so I have four contrasts then, and each, as I say, is accompanied by something that stays the same. So first of all this morning, we now have an ascended master, but still offer the same prayer. That's the first heading. We now have an ascended master, but still offer the same prayer. So chapter 9, verses 37 and 38 are famous verses, and like many famous verses, we tend to divorce them from their context. For several years now, our government has been in austerity mode, and so there have been public spending cuts right across the board. They have been the order of the day. And we've become accustomed then to hearing leading figures in the NHS and in the police and so on bemoaning these cuts and making grave announcements about being overstretched and under-resourced and about the unsustainability of the present setup. And I think that the mood of Jesus' words here in verses 37 and 38 are somewhat similar to those grave announcements that I'm talking about. Jesus doesn't utter these words in a jaunty tone with a big grin across his face. Who are these few laborers to whom he refers? The laborers are few. Who are they? I mean, they can't include Peter and James and John and the rest of the gang because they are about to be appointed precisely in order to rectify the paucity of labourers that presently exists. So who are the labourers, the few labourers mentioned in verse 37? Well, I think this is dry humour on Jesus' part. As one of the commentators puts it, it's an understatement. He's the only labourer. Jesus is the only labourer at this point. And in verse 35 then, he has been single-handedly trying to reach all the cities and villages, healing every disease and every affliction. And he simply can't do it. Those of you who are teachers have perhaps had this experience. You've given the class a piece of work to do, and you're helping a boy over here who just can't get his head around this piece of work that you've given the class to do. And while you're helping that boy, there's a girl over on the other side of the classroom, and she's getting increasingly impatient because she's stuck and she needs help. And conscious then of her increasingly desperate efforts to attract your attention, you eventually exclaim, "Look, I cannot be in two places at once." And Jesus, being truly human, was similarly unable to be in two places at once, and nor were his energy levels any greater than ours are. And so here he is, and having conducted all that ministry in verse 35, in verse 36, there's still crowds of people needing his help. He's only scratched the surface. It's like painting the fourth bridge, as we say. However many people he helps, there always seem to be more who are in need of his help. And his utterance in verses 37 and 38 then, it's an expression of being overwhelmed. It's like the police chief or the bigwig from the NHS saying, "This is too much. It's unsustainable. I'm at my limits." That's what Jesus is saying. "I'm at the limits of my capacity here. I need more resources." Which is why he then appoints these 12 apostles. And it's why in verses 7 and 8 of chapter 10, he gives them exactly the same ministry that he has just been exercising. They are effectively auxiliaries being drafted in order to supplement his overstretched ministry. So that if you're a needy person at the other end of Galilee from where Jesus happens to be right now, you might not get an encounter with Jesus, but hopefully you'll get an encounter with Peter or with John or with Judas instead of Jesus. This is a team ministry now. Jesus is no longer a lone ranger, sinking beneath all these demands being placed upon him. Now he's one of 13 men who are covering the region. And so once we've established then that that's what's going on here, we're ready to appreciate this first contrast of ours this morning. We, this morning, are in a very different situation from the one that we encounter here in our passage, because we now have an ascended master. Jesus is no longer located on earth. And he's no longer overwhelmed then by geographical challenges and by the struggle of coping with competing claims on his time and his energy. He's ascended into heaven now, and in ascending into heaven, he has entered this special partnership with the Holy Spirit, whereby he can now be active in more than one place at once. He can be active in unlimited places at once. And although, yes, the ascended master still appoints human beings to proclaim his gospel, those human beings aren't like these 12 men here. They aren't Jesus' auxiliaries who supplement his ministry. They are his agents who mediate his ministry. He speaks through them. So that today at NREC, you're not getting myself and Alan instead of Jesus, in the way that in a Galilean village you might have got Peter or Andrew instead of Jesus. No, you're getting Jesus today through myself and Alan. He's the preacher here this morning. I'm not the preacher. I'm just a mechanism. I'm a medium. I'm a channel. He's the preacher. And at the very same time that Jesus is preaching here, he's preaching down the road at Welbeck Road Church and at Walkergate and at Jesmond, and in many, many other places. And he isn't wilting at these strains being put on him, and he isn't getting exhausted by it all. He doesn't have the look this morning of a weary local councillor trying to keep our public services running on a shoestring. It's effortless for him. By the end of today, there will be new converts in Malawi, and in Algeria, and in China, and in Brazil, and in Iran. And in each case, they will have heard the voice of Jesus softly pleading with their hearts. We're talking about a geographical scope that dwarfs the region of Galilee that he's struggling to cope with here. And yet he won't have broken sweat reaching all those new converts today. What a fantastic thing that is, isn't it? What a glorious contrast that is between the ascended, untiring Jesus now using men as his mouthpieces, and the earthbound, exhausted Jesus then needing men as his helpers. But while we should indeed then glory in that contrast this morning and be so thankful that we live in this age of the ascended master, there is this other part of my heading too. There's something that still stays the same. We do still offer the same prayer. Verse 38 of chapter 9. Pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. We still do that, but we adapt the prayer now in the light of everything we've just been saying, so that the laborers for whom we pray now are not those helpers that Jesus needs to work alongside him in a team in Galilee. No, the laborers for whom we pray are those mouthpieces whom Jesus uses to himself powerfully address people all over the world. We adapt the prayer in that way, but we still offer it. We still offer this prayer to the Lord of the harvest. In some Christian circles today, a great stress is placed on 2 Timothy 2:2. What you have heard from me, Paul says to Timothy, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. And that's a healthy stress, that the next generation of Christian teachers must be actively sought out. But 2 Timothy 2:2 must be balanced always with Ephesians 4:11 and 12. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry. In other words, the production of Christian teachers should never be reduced to a merely human recruitment drive. Christian teachers, at the same time as being humanly recruited, are also divinely given. And the divinely given aspect then means that prayer like the one Jesus is describing here, is always appropriate and necessary. Are we praying in this way? Are we praying that the ascended master will give to his church the men he will then speak powerfully through for the conversion of unbelievers and for the upbuilding of believers? And so that's the first thing. We now have an ascended master, and we glory in that, and the massive seismic change that that involves. But we still offer the same prayer. Secondly, we now have an expanded mission, but still retain the same priority. We now have an expanded mission, but still retain the same priority. And so the apostles then are appointed. And in verse 5 of chapter 10, Jesus begins instructing them. And this is his opening command to them. Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So their mission then, it was to be a purely Jewish affair, confined to just that one ethnic group. And already then, our second contrast this morning is obvious to you all. We now have an expanded mission. The Church of Jesus Christ no longer takes its cue from Matthew 10, 5 and 6. It now, of course, takes its cue from Matthew 28, verse 19. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. And again, just as we should glory in the reality of a now ascended master, we should also glory in the reality of a now expanded mission. I mean, we're so accustomed to this, aren't we, that we can easily take it for granted. And we tend to view chapter 28, verse 19 as a given. And we come to chapter 10, verses 5 and 6, and we think, oh, what a strange idea, the gospel just being confined to Israel. You know, really, it should be the other way around. It should be 28:19 that makes our jaws drop. Wow. The God of Israel. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The God of Sinai. The God of the burning bush. That God also includes the nations in his gracious purposes. That's amazing. That's how we should think. You know, we must constantly go back, mustn't we, to that foundational biblical principle that the human race fallen in Adam is utterly, utterly undeserving of God's favor. So that if God had never come up with a gospel for anybody, that would have been perfectly reasonable. That's how it ought to be. That's what you would expect. If, on the other hand, God had come up with a gospel that was for one human being, just one human being in the whole of history, somewhere on the planet, some random guy, and the gospel was for that one person, I mean, that would be extraordinary grace on God's part. If God, however, had come up with a gospel that was for a whole nation, well, that would be sensational. Stunning grace. And so for God to come up with a gospel that is for all nations, That's off the scale, Grace. That defies superlatives. I'm saying we must never treat Matthew 28:19 as obvious and commonplace. Even here in chapter 10 and this mission to Israel, we're already wading in a deep, deep sea of grace. In chapter 28:19 and the expanded mission, we're swimming in a fathomless ocean of grace. Even this text here, "Go nowhere among the Gentiles," that already testifies to thrilling mercy, for why should God look favorably on any nation and not consign all humanity to hell? The "go everywhere among the Gentiles" of chapter 28:19, that takes this mercy to a whole new level. Let's glory, I'm saying, in our breathtaking situation today, where the gospel goes forth to people of every nation, tribe, people, and language. This wonderfully expanded mission. But we need to notice, before we move on, that once again, there's something that remains the same. My heading was that we now have an expanded mission, but still retain the same priority. What priority am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about the priority of Jews over Gentiles. Because you go to the book of Acts and the ministry of Paul, and certainly you don't find Paul dismissing the Gentile world in the way that Jesus does here, because Paul is in the Matthew 28:19 era, the age of the expanded mission. Indeed, he's the great apostle, isn't he, to the Gentiles. So you don't find him dismissing the Gentile world and overlooking the Gentile world, certainly. But you do find him in city after city after city, making a beeline, first of all, for the Jewish synagogue and proclaiming the gospel to the Jews. And then only after that, going to the Gentiles of those cities. And then you move on from the book of Acts and you come to Romans. And there's that epic verse in Romans chapter 1 that I quoted at the start of our service this morning, Romans chapter 1 verse 16, and we almost always quote it, don't we, in an abridged form. "I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes," and we stop there. Paul doesn't stop there. To the Jew first. The gospel. The gospel he's about to set out in such glorious new covenant fullness in this letter. That gospel, he says, is to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So there's still a Jewish priority. There's still a to the Jew first aspect to the gospel. Paul elaborates on it, doesn't he, in that same epistle there in chapter 11. And in Romans 11, he describes the people of God as a tree. And Jews, he says, are the natural branches of that tree. Now, he also says that most of those natural branches have been cut off. That is, most of the Jews presently, he's saying, in the grip of unbelief, and they're not actually members of God's people. And he also says that conversely, a whole load of wild alien branches have been grafted in, i.e. many Gentiles have believed and become members of God's people. But none of that alters the fact that the Jews are the natural branches. Yes, they may have been largely detached from the tree in Paul's day. They may still be largely detached from the tree in our day. But they're still the natural branches. It's still their tree. Each year at the Banner of Truth Ministers Conference, some of you also attend the Banner of Truth Ministers Conference, and you may or may not be aware that the Welsh ministers, one evening of the conference every year, they have their own very secretive little gathering after the last session of the day. And at this meeting of the Welsh ministers then, there's kind of Pringles freely flowing and fizzy drinks, and they have a great time, and one of the speakers will come along and they'll interview him and all the rest of it. Well, one year there was a a shortage at the conference of Welsh ministers. And so this meeting, it was going to be a very small meeting, and the guy who was organizing it, he was a bit concerned about this. And just before it was about to start, he spotted me in the corridor and he said, "Oh, you've got a Welsh wife, you can come along to the meeting." And so I went along to the meeting, and once in the meeting then, I was able to enjoy the full access to the Pringles and to the fizzy drinks and all the rest of it. But nonetheless, it wasn't an obvious fit, me being in that Welsh minister's gathering, the same way it would have been if I was from Pontypridd or Llanelli or somewhere. And similarly then, we Gentiles, we can now get into the people of God. The way I could get in that night to that meeting, we Gentiles, we can now get into the people of God. And once in, we have full access to all the blessings and benefits enjoyed by all the people of God. But we're not an obvious fit in the people of God, the way the Jews are an obvious fit in the people of God. And so whatever Jeremy Corbyn and his mates might think of the Jewish people, you and I as Christians should hold them in the highest regard, and we should pray for them, and we should see their unbelief as a particularly tragic phenomenon, and we should pray that the natural branches might be restored to their own tree, and that there might be an influx into the people of God of those who, with Jewish blood flowing through their veins, most readily belong to the people of God. So we now have an ascended master, but still offer the same prayer. We now have an expanded mission, but still retain the same priority. Thirdly, we now have a fuller message, but still enjoy the same prospect. We now have a fuller message, but still enjoy the same prospects. Because Jesus continues then to these apostles in verse 7 of chapter 10, "Proclaim as you go, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand." So that was to be their message. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. What does that mean? Well, it's important that we don't detach that from what comes next. Jesus says, "Proclaim as you go, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons." We have the same kind of coupling presence with Jesus' own ministry back in chapter 9, 35. He goes around proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. And similarly here, these apostles are to proclaim the kingdom and also heal and drive out demons and all the rest of it. And I think we're to understand then that these miracles, these healings and exorcisms, they were to accompany the apostles' message as a kind of visual aid, if you like, of that message. Again and again, as we've been going through Matthew, I've brought you back to the Bible's big story, because I don't think you can understand Matthew's gospel apart from an understanding of that big story. The big story being then that there was once a king, King Adam, in Eden, and he had everything under his control, but King Adam messed things up. He disobeyed God, and because he messed things up, the creation spiraled out of his control and became filled with all kinds of nasty things, demons and illnesses and death and all the rest of it. King Jesus then comes in order to replay the story and to obey God and to bring everything back under his control. And the apostles' message then, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, it really looked forward to that. It looked forward to that day that we've considered recently in 1 Corinthians 15, when everything would be under King Jesus' feet. All illness, all disease, all death, all ugly realities under King Jesus' feet. And so that was their message, and so they accompanied that message with this little illustration, this little glimpse of what that will look like. This, by casting out these demons and these illnesses, it was a little visual aid of the day they were pointing to in their message when King Jesus would have all things under his feet. Now, you and I have a fuller message than they did. When I was coming back from Lewes last weekend, the final stage of my journey was a train trip from Edinburgh to Newcastle, and the train that I got on, you know how these big intercity trains, they just have a little digital sign on the front of them saying where they're going. Taunton, it said. The train that I stepped onto, it had Taunton written on the front. There's no suggestion of the countless stations that the train was going to stop at on its way to Taunton. And it's a bit like that with the apostles' message here, that the kingdom is at hand, the day when Jesus will be in control of everything and all nasty things will be under his feet. There's no suggestion in their message of the route by which that is going to come about, namely, that one day, in order to have all creation under his feet, King Jesus must first of all have nails put through his feet. There's no suggestion of that in their message. No suggestion that before he can bring all things under his control, he must hang naked on a Roman cross, suffering indescribably. But that's what we proclaim, isn't it? We know the fuller picture, the fuller story. We proclaim Christ crucified. I mean, chapter 9:36 talks, doesn't it, about Jesus' compassion, such a strong word in the Greek there that Matthew uses to do with the bowels. That's where this compassion came from in Jesus, from deep, deep within him. It was a gut thing. But we know, don't we, just how far that compassion took him. That it took him to the cross of Calvary. It took him to the suffering of Golgotha. And what a wonderful thing then to have that full message this morning. The full message of King Jesus having to go via the cross to the crown. Having to go via Golgotha to that day when finally all things will be under his feet. What a thing to be able to sing this morning of a crucified Jesus and pray through a crucified Jesus and revel in a crucified Jesus. We have now a fuller message. But once again, we must notice the other part of my heading. We still enjoy the same prospects. So just as with that train I got on a Monday, yes, it may have had a tortuous route to get to Taunton, but it still got to Taunton. So Jesus had to go via the cross to get to that day that the apostles were pointing to, but he will get to that day that the apostles were pointing to. And we must be men and women of the cross, but we mustn't stop at the cross as though the cross was an end in itself. As much as we look back to that event, we must look forward to this great future event when Jesus will finally unveil a renewed creation, no less. All nasty things gone forever. The puny expulsion of Galilee's woes that these apostles achieved expanded onto a cosmic scale as all the woes of the world are driven out by our majestic King. Are you looking forward to that? For every visit to the BBC website from which you walk away so depressed because there's this disaster and that atrocity and this war going on, for every visit to the BBC website, do you revisit the biblical hope of a new world that King Jesus is going to bring about? What a prospect. And then this ministry of exorcism and healing, we just see the tiniest, flimsiest, faintest little preview of a day that is coming. Because our Jesus went to the cross, he will one day present to his Father a creation utterly, utterly restored. So we now have an ascended Master, but still offer the same prayer. We now have an expanded mission, but still retain the same priority. We now have a fuller message, but still enjoy the same prospect. One more heading. We now have a changed ministry, but still witness the same process. We now have a changed ministry, but still witness the same process. So just cast your eye quickly at verses 9 to 15 of chapter 10, and just try and get the logic of these verses. So Jesus tells them in verse 9 not to take stuff with them as they go out on their mission. And he gives the reason for that at the end of verse 10. It's not because he wants them to starve and to waste away. It's because rather that he's assuming that they will be fed and watered and looked after and given accommodation and all the rest of it wherever they go by the people to whom they're ministering. The laborer deserves his food. But then that raises the issue of where that might not happen, and where they might go and minister in a place and rather than being accepted and given hospitality, they are rejected instead. And that's really what Jesus then talks about for the rest of those verses up until verse 15. And indeed, as I said earlier, that idea of hostility and rejection, it then continues throughout the rest of this whole chapter. And you'll notice how Jesus tells them to deal then with rejection and with opposition. And it's pretty uncompromising how they're to deal with it. So they are to withdraw any words of peace that they've uttered over any house where they are then rejected. And then they are to shake the dust off their feet in connection with that house, or indeed even the whole town. It's what Jews did, as many of you know, when returning from a journey in Gentile territory. They didn't want even so much as a speck of dust, Gentile dust, to still be on their shoes as they arrived home. And so they would very ceremoniously shake the dust off their feet on the border. And Jesus is saying, treat that Jewish town that's opposing you, treat it as a pagan place. Treat it as a non-covenant place. Treat it as a heathen place if it will not accept the gospel. So he's saying rejecters. If you're rejected in your gospel proclamation in a village or town or house, reject those who have rejected the gospel. And again then, here we have a contrast, don't we? For ourselves. I mean, you go to the book of Acts, and you go, for instance, to Acts 18, and there's Paul in Corinth, and he's having a hard time, and he's been rejected right, left, and center. And all kinds of opposition have been stirred up against him, and he wants to leave the place, and he's about to leave the place. And remember how Jesus tells him in a vision, stay here, Paul, keep on ministering. I have many people in this city. And so there's this New Testament emphasis on perseverance, on keeping going in the face of opposition, on the very real possibility of a very slow process of making inroads with the gospel. And it's why then we pray, for instance, for the Swansons in Cyprus. Been there more than 30 years, Andrew and Daphne, and now James and Rachel, and so little fruits. And we're not saying, well, why on earth don't they just leave the place? We're praying that even yet things might happen and blessing might come to that work. There's this New Testament emphasis now on persevering with the proclamation of the gospel. And again, then, we must be clear on that. But again, there's this second part to my heading, but we still witness the same process. What do I mean by that? Well, there's a strange tension, isn't there, in our passage? Because you go back to the start almost, verse 37, and Jesus has said that the harvest is plentiful. So as he looks out on Galilee, he says the harvest is plentiful. There are people waiting to embrace the message. And yet now you come to this section of the passage, verses 9 to 15 of chapter 10, and he's envisaging all this hostility and all this opposition. in the same area, and it's still in Galilee where these apostles are going to be ministering. And you think, well, which is it, Jesus? Is there a plentiful harvest, or is there going to be a whole load of opposition and rejection? And I think the answer is both. Both. And they seem incompatible. It doesn't seem like there can be a great harvest if there's this level of opposition and rejection. And if there's this level of opposition and rejection, then how can there be a plentiful harvest? And yet, is that not exactly the same process that we witness in the world today? I love that parable Jesus tells in Mark 4, a short little parable of the seed being sown and the crop growing and growing and growing. And the farmer goes out and sees this crop growing, and it says, one little phrase, Mark 4:27, it grows, he knows not how. The farmer's nonplussed, how's this happening? It doesn't seem possible that this crop is growing like this. He doesn't know how on earth this is happening. Isn't that what we see in the world today? I mean, we get such different reports, don't we? And we hear of massive gospel expansion and places where people are coming to Christ in huge numbers, and yet at the same time we hear of massive opposition, massive persecution, whole areas of the world that seem so opposed to Jesus Christ. And you think, how can these two things be compatible? And yet it's just how it works in God's arrangement of things. It's how it will always work. It's why in my reading of the New Testament, I don't think those are right who, on the one hand, think the people of God are just going to dwindle and dwindle so that when Christ comes, they'll just be a pathetic little handful. No, there'll be a great harvest. The mustard seed will become the huge tree. The yeast will work its way through the whole dough. But at the same time, I don't think those are right either who predict some great golden age when Christianity will exist in this world unchallenged and uncontested and unopposed. There will be great fruit and great opposition right to the end. So much opposition that we'll think, how can there be any fruit? That's how it would be in Galilee for those 3 years. And that's how it will be until Christ returns. And so this morning, let's rejoice that we're not where they were. But let's also learn these lessons that still apply to ourselves. Amen.